Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is O'Connor. How you doing?
Hello, Phil. Good afternoon.
Well, today we're going to talk with Robin Philpott quickly about the over-the-weekend news of the biggest student strike in the history of North America. And we're going to find out what happened at the Formula One race, we hope. And also there's apparently a big meeting of the Power, sponsored by the Power Corporation. They got a great name for themselves, bless their hearts. Power. Anyhow, and then shortly after that, we're going to be speaking to Glenn Ford of Black Agenda Report about the conditions of the in Rwanda and the kind of regime there and how it came to be an American client and why it seems to have impunity from any interference in whatever it wants to do in neighboring countries. That will be Glenn Ford, followed by Charles Roach, Toronto lawyer and known internationally, and he's one of the great champions on the issue of freedom of conscience and his principal stand against swearing an oath to the Queen of England in order to become a Canadian citizen, which you're right, sounds kind of odd, doesn't it? And then at the latter part of the program, we will speak with Zafar Ben-Gaish about some ugly developments in Syria that are not reported here. Specifically, we're going to ask him about this matter of the kidnapping of Lebanese pilgrims by so-called the Free Syrian Army. It's an ugly case, and we want to know more about it. Phil, we have something. Eva Bartlett's going to be in town.
Eva Bartlett will be here on Thursday, and she's speaking at Beit Zetun. And they have an ongoing exhibit that opened last week. It'll be running through the 24th called Children of Gaza, an Eyewitness Account. And she is going to speak about the situation that led to that artwork. So that's Thursday night at 7 o'clock.
What's the street?
Beit Zetun.
762, isn't it?
612.
We will come back.
612 Markham Street.
Beit Zetun. on
Thursday night. And tomorrow night, our old friend Rob Ralph, who recently has relocated in Owen Sound, will be reading at the St. Clair Kickett Festival. That's at the Silverthorne Library, 1748 St. Clair Avenue West, 7 to 8:30. He'll be appearing with Alejandro Bravo and Francisco Ruiz Martinez tomorrow night at 7 p.m.
Thanks a lot. Robin Philpott has joined us on the line. Are you there, Robin?
Hi, Phil. How are you doing?
Not bad. Well, okay. You have the most, the biggest student strike in the history of North America. I mean,
yeah.
Perhaps the world. I don't know.
We're in competition with the Chilean students.
And certainly in magnitude. This is turning into a cultural, political phenomena. And now you had the Formula One racers were in town, and suddenly people were being arrested who were not demonstrating, et cetera. So bring us up.
You probably saw that Amir Kadir, who is a member of the National Assembly for Quebec Solidaire, he's a left social democrat and a sovereigntist, was arrested at a pots and pans demonstration in Quebec City on Monday night, and then Wednesday morning, the police went and showed up at his home in Montreal, eight policemen, and arrested his daughter and five or six other people. And these are people who had been involved in a place where they'd gone and set up a blockade, very short blockade on the Jacques Cartier Bridge, and so they had to report to the police every Monday. But the police didn't stop them last Monday, and they didn't wait until today. Mm-hmm. They went in the day before the festivities around the Grand Prix began, and they arrested her. She spent the weekend in prison, as did everybody but one of the people. They've been in prison since they were picked up on Wednesday until today. Mm-hmm. And it's basically misdemeanors they're being accused of.
And by the way, this is nakedly political business, right?
They
didn't want them to be around while Mr. Villeneuve and his friends were at the big hotels having a good time. So they took them off the street.
Yeah,
isn't that what it is? I mean, this is naked power playing around.
Yeah, that is exactly what it is. They wanted to intimidate other people, get them not to go to the demonstrations. They wanted to show their power, and at some of the demonstrations, they have, you know, the logo for the police here in Montreal is the SPVM, Service de Police de la Ville de Montréal. So it's SPVM, and so everybody, one of the chances, SSPVM, uh-huh. Political police. And so.
Oh, wait till the editors of the Globe see that.
Yeah, well,
I mean, they have just had enough young men. They're going to put their foot down.
There's a lot of political.
Mocking your elders.
There's one thing I did want to tell you. Montreal, these days, for the last 5-6 days, is like a city under siege. There are policemen everywhere. They're just crawling with policemen to protect, basically, and the elite who are here for the Grand Prix. And then this week, there's a conference called the Montreal Conference, the Forum of the Americas, and it's something. I think we talked about it last week about this set up by this Desmarais family, but they flex their muscles.
And Mr. Harper is there.
Harper's speaking as we speak. Charest spoke. There's about 7 ministers in the federal government who are speaking. Alan Greenspan, a former guy from the Fed,
yes,
who's a close friend of the Desmarais, is the keynote speaker.
And a personal friend and admirer of Ayn Rand.
Right, exactly. Yes. They've got. A guy named Strobe Talbot, who's of the Brookings Institute. Matt Murray.
Where's a policeman when you need one?
Wall Street Journal. Mm-hmm. Then they've got they have Fraser Institute people. They've got Gary Dewar, mm-hmm. former NDP leader, who's
ambassador. He's very former these days.
Yeah, very former. A lot of former people. They've got the Mark Carney, the Bank of Canada, and they're they're trying to create a kind of a Davos, the in uh-huh. Switzerland, where they basically. Established policy, which in fact comes out with where they come out with these things like forcing indebtedness on students, transfer of wealth from the poor to the rich. That's what if you look over the program, they've got austerity, they've got towards a new capitalism. That's where Alan.
Did they say that?
Yeah, this is on their program. And,
That's it. It takes my breath away. You're not supposed to use that word, you know.
No.
You're supposed to say civilization.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. None of them, I suppose, were wearing red squares.
No. And they were stopping people who were wearing red squares, profiling them, instead of stopping them and saying they were removed, for instance, on the weekend from anywhere near where the Grand Prix
was. You couldn't wear the red square. This is Robin Philpott, author, publisher, and as had several distinguished books about the politics of Quebec.
Robin, I just want to tell you a cultural story quickly, because you did mention it's cultural. There's this this young, maybe 30-something, author, singer, storyteller. He's developed a kind of a new form, and he's just inspired people tremendously. His name is Fred Pellerin. People probably wouldn't know him, but he's really he fills up the halls, and yes. he basically starts from a small town between Montreal and Quebec City. He was to be awarded the Order of Quebec, it's l'Ordre National du Québec. It's one of the highest distinctions mm-hmm. of honor. And at that award ceremony, there was Desmarais' wife was getting one too. And there was a big ceremony, and Charest was going to take advantage of all these people's presence. Well, he refused the order. He refused to go there. He said, uh-huh. The people of Quebec are in a major social crisis. I'm very honored to be given this, but I'm sorry I cannot come.
See,
I will not come.
That is great. That's
and he didn't go. And the minister of the culture in Charest's government said, well, he's got the right to do that, but we know when he wears his red square, that means violence and intimidation.
Oh, my.
And this is like, what you have here is a case of trying to criminalize.
Yes.
Popular desire.
Democratic expression.
Yeah, criminalizing.
Yeah.
It's like the same. Here's this man who's so peaceful. I mean, he's just basically using words with a bit of music. He's just.
There have been a few poets hanged in history, so.
Yeah.
Robin, we appreciate all that.
Okay.
It's a nice update and very encouraging, too. Thank you very, very much.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Robin Philpott. And we're going to be talking shortly to Glenn Ford of the Black Agenda Report. And it's blackagendareport.com. And he has, I swear, one of the greatest radio voices anyone. So it's always a pleasure to get a chance to talk to him. But recently on the Black Agenda Report, he took up this issue of Rwanda, as well as he's dealing with issues of to do with Syria and the tactics the empire uses to dominate the world. And one of the titles of his recent piece is The Endless Genocide, Rwanda Still Spreading Chaos and Death in the Congo. And the second one is Mercenaries for Empire, Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. And they play such a big role in a policy coming out of Washington and Paris, London, because before they bomb anybody, they have to have the stamp from the Human Rights Watch saying it's necessary and it's a good deed. And I think we are joined right now by that man, Glenn Ford. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I am, and I'm so glad to be here.
Well, Glenn, you've been doing wonderful commentary on urgent issues, and those that are terribly neglected by the Western media, which puts us all kind of always at a disadvantage when we're trying to understand a crisis. Well, you put your finger on one that I think is probably the most neglected, at least in these circles, and that is this government of Rwanda, which seems to enjoy a very special kind of relationship particularly to Washington, but some of the other major Western states. And you've taken it up in an article, editorial called The Endless Genocide, Rwanda Still Spreading Chaos and Death in the Congo. Is there something new unfolding there in the Congo?
It's actually not new. It is unfolding. It's been unfolding at least since 1996. Since 1996, 6 million Congolese have died because of the Rwandan and Ugandan intervention in Congo. Rwanda and Uganda are the cat's paws of U.S. imperialism in Africa. They are the mercenaries. They're the ones who do the U.S. bidding, not just in Congo with its vast mineral resources, but all over the continent. That's what they've hired themselves out to do. And it's not that like you are missing some little chapters of history that are unfolding. Mm-hmm. 6 million people, this is the biggest genocide since World War II. This is a bigger genocide than Vietnam. This is the greatest, not tragedy, but crime that has happened in the world in the last 20 years or more, or 40. Not recognizing that is having a hole in your soul.
Mm-hmm. It is. It's amazing because, by the way, there's no shortage of African leaders who have pointed this out, but it seems to be a kind of a device where the media treats those who comment like the leader of Congo, actually.
Oh, right? It's not even just African leaders. This escapes from the United Nations, which is, in most times, a captive of the United States and its imperial partners. But this crime is so huge, so horrific, so uncoverable, that the United Nations has responded, albeit sometimes with leaks. That means when a document is leaked, it means the bureaucracy of the United Nations can't be controlled, and they're saying, look at this report. Uganda, the other cat's paw of the United States, was assessed $30 million as a penalty for its intervention in the Congo. I don't believe that $30 million is adequate compensation for that great crime, but it does mean that even the United Nations, under the sway of the United States, could not ignore the evidence. Mm-hmm. And there have been a number of United Nations reports, usually under what they call mapping. That is, let's find out where the atrocities, the genocides occurred, and map how they occurred. So they call them mapping plans. That's not very exciting. New UN mapping plan. Well, it was a map of the genocide, like you could have a map of Dachau, a map of Treblinka.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of mapping plans these were.
To put that a time frame, are they speaking about the invasion of that took place in 96, and then there was a subsequent one, 98, and then the two of them, I remember when the two of them got into a gunfight with each other in Kisangani, Uganda and Rwandan armies fought each other in the Congo.
The United States has fostered a wild, wild west with its paid African mercenaries. I think before we get into the internal rivalries between mercenaries that then with crazed, mostly child soldiers, results in all kinds of conflicts between them, we ought to really talk about what is U.S. policy there in the eastern Congo, which is the repository of vast mineral wealth that the United States has declared is of strategic value to what it calls the free world. And what U.S. policy has been in Africa since decolonization, certainly since the Eisenhower administration, has been a policy of imposing chaos where it cannot exercise direct control. And so in Congo, after the imposition of Mobutu, and that is after the execution of Lumumba, for many decades, the United States was able to exercise through its surrogate, Mobutu, control over the Congo. When Mobutu left the scene, then the United States either had to impose another Mobutu-like figure or figure out something else. And its option always in Africa, and now it appears around the world, but certainly in Africa historically, has been to create a situation of chaos. But chaos is not a passive situation. You have to get your actors in there actively creating chaos. And for that purpose, they engaged the regime in Rwanda and the regime in Uganda. And so all of this must be understood as part of a U.S. scenario to control that part of Africa with its vast mineral resources that Mobutu used to control by other means. That means is chaos, and it results in genocide, 6 million dead.
Yeah. Well, it's a very important story. By the way, I kind of congratulate you. Your method at blackagendareport.com of editorial comment, it really has it. I hope people will go to that site. I want to ask you now, too, about speaking of creating chaos. I know you have a decided opinion about what the U.S. is and its allies are up to with Syria. Can you tell us what your take is on this present crisis there?
Well, some of what the U.S. is up to should be obvious to your listeners. I know if they're your listeners, then they're used to hearing an intelligent and objective analysis. And so some is quite obvious. Obviously, the United States wants regime change. Hillary Clinton is yelling like a banshee about Assad must go, just as she yelled like some kind of banshee that Gaddafi must go. We understand what's happening in the public sphere. But much, much more fundamental things are happening below the radar that we're allowed to see, that is, that which the corporate media gives to us every day. And I really want to emphasize this. Yes, the United States is out for regime change in Syria, but the United States is not in control of events, not even in control of its own policy there. With the advent of what people call the Arab Spring or the Arab Awakening, U.S. imperialism really had no policy. It had no foot soldiers there, and it was at a loss as to how it's going to respond with the loss of Mubarak and other puppets of U.S. imperialism. And it was interesting to watch CNN. I know you guys have different habits of watching than we do here in
we
the U.S.
We have two more choices.
I think they're not that different. But watching CNN was a trip when the so-called Arab Spring or Awakening began, because CNN for a whole week the news readers didn't know what to say. They were dumbstruck. They are dumb already, but they were struck by their dumbness.
Yeah.
And the reason that they had nothing to say, had no script, is because the State Department hadn't provided them a script. And the reason the State Department hadn't provided them a script was because the U.S. State Department had no script. Mm-hmm. And that was what was so fascinating about that period. The U.S. was at a loss as to its response.
Yeah.
And so about 2 weeks into the Tahrir Square crisis, the United States finally leaked through its New York Times and the usual suspects its conclusion that that Washington preferred kings to autocrats. That is, it preferred Saudi Arabia and Qatar and the United Arab Emirates and their sheikhs and all that to Mubarak's, who already were being thrust into the dustbin of history. And that set in motion the reality that we now face. That the United States cannot effectively move in this new configuration in the Arab world, in this Arab Spring-like environment. It cannot move directly without the direct collaboration of the Saudis and Qatar.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're back to a situation that kind of looks like 1980 Afghanistan, where the United States and the Saudis and the Pakistanis and the Egyptians, through the old regime, basically created out of whole cloth the jihadi movement, the Salafis, and their worldwide jihadi movement. It didn't exist before, but they funded it. Now, in this new crisis, occasioned by the Arab Awakening, they have gone back to that trough, and they are now... They are now really dependent upon the Saudis and the Qataris and all their Salafi, Wahhabi foot soldiers to exert some kind of control in that region. Mm-hmm. So we see that the Salafis, the jihadis, were the main troops that were armed and mobilized in Libya to overthrow Gaddafi. And these same Libyan forces are now in their thousands in Syria, but the Qataris and the Saudis have contributed thousands more to this jihad. This battle to unseat Assad is a jihad, and the United States, although it appears to be in control, is not. It is in the hands of these Saudi and other hereditary thieving rulers.
Yeah. The same and
there will be such a huge blowback, my friend, that it makes the blowback that included 9/11 from their previous wartime, they made the war, and they chose the time, wartime association in the 1980s in Afghanistan looks so tame by comparison. This is really a new age, and the imperialists cannot win this one. These jihadis and their ideology is political Islam. Mm-hmm. It behaves as a nationalism, and that kind of nationalism cannot coexist for long with imperialism.
We're speaking to Glenn Ford, blackagendareport.com. And I want to get your comment on a group I would call enablers, and I know you have strong opinions about. You can find this at blackagendareport.com, an excellent commentary with it. That is the role of everything U.S. does is in the name, of course, of good things, humanitarianism and human rights. And there are two very noted agencies called Amnesty and Human Rights Watch. And what kind of role are they playing in the issues that we've just been discussing?
They are a false opposition. You know, in order to seem authentic, in order to create the charade of democracy, power must have a nominal opposition, a loyal opposition. And that's what Human Rights Watch is, and that's what Amnesty International is. they are a loyal opposition to imperialism. They are loyal to imperialism, and they put forward a front of opposition. But in terms of these so-called humanitarian interventions, and this is really the Obama doctrine, although certainly was introduced before Obama, but it is a full-fledged doctrine under Obama. Mm-hmm. They become the ideological point men, justifying the aggression. And so we have the loyal opposition actually in the front of the propaganda. Why don't you attack Syria more effectively? Mm-hmm. Why are you allowing, you know...
Didn't they say stay the course recently in Afghanistan? They got a very embarrassing situation where they said you have to protect those women. NATO has to do that.
It's very sad that people in the West, under the sway of the corporate media, which does not inform but disinforms and erases history, the regime in Afghanistan that the Soviets tried to come to the rescue of, that's what's called the Soviet invasion. I guess it was an invasion. I mean, it was people from one country going to another. Mm-hmm. But they were coming to rescue a leftist Afghan regime. That regime was already engaged in a fight with jihadis who were not armed by superpowers, so they just had World War II type rifles. And they were killing and cutting the throats of teachers and women who were trying to spread throughout the country education for everybody, including young girls. That was a capital offense under those jihadis. These are the people that the United States came to the rescue of and created what we now know as the International Jihadi Network, which includes al-Qaeda, but let's not get all distracted. It's much bigger than that. Mm-hmm. All right? And so now these people are saying that the only way that Afghanistan can be saved from these Muslim fundamentalists is for the U.S. To intervene, when the U.S. is the one that armed and financed them and created this. Well, of course, that's not what the United States' purpose is in Afghanistan. We know it's about pipelines. We know it's about trying to contain the rising power of China and collaboration between China and Russia, which together make up most of Eurasia and about a quarter of the world's population. Mm-hmm. We know this is a great game, and it is pornographic. Pornographic to try to say that the United States is fighting this war on behalf of Afghan women who they condemned to the mercies of Islamic fundamentalists 30 years ago.
Thank you very much. I think you're dead on. I have to agree. Glenn Ford, it's been a pleasure talking to you. You got a great site, blackagendareport.com, and we look forward to talking to you again. You're going to be up here, we understand, in September giving a speech in Montreal.
In Montreal, I mean, you know, Canada's a big place, and if I say I'm in Montreal, that doesn't mean I'm right next door.
Yeah, but we'll all take the train. We're going to see that. Thanks very much.
All right, thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye. That's
right,
Glenn
bye-bye.
Ford. Glenn Ford, blackagendareport.com. I have a quote from a Syrian foreign minister, the best one so far as I'm concerned, just in terms of encapsulating. He says, listen to Hillary Clinton, you can't be an arsonist and a fireman. You got to make up your mind. Are you helping us put a fire out, or are you trying to make a fire? So, anyway, that was great, and we're going to take a quick break, come back, get Charles Roach, and later we'll be talking to Zafar Bengay. And we're back. It's the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. You can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and you can check us out. All these interviews are available at taylor-report.com. And we're going to be speaking shortly to Charles Roach, and as I say, later also with Zafar Bengash, also about the Syria matter. Rob Roth is talking tomorrow.
Reading his poetry at the St. Clair Kickett Festival, Bone Shaker Reading, it's called. That's at the St. Clair Silverthorne Library at 1748 St. Clair Avenue West. That's between Lansdowne and Keele.
Good.
And that's 7 p.m. tomorrow night.
Yeah. By the way, now we spoke to Robin earlier. I just point out, Rick Salutin had a great column. The beauty of the Internet, just go dig it up, on supporting the Quebec student. But we're joined now by none other than Charles Roach. Are you there, sir?
Hello, Phil.
How are you doing, Charles?
Well, I'm doing not badly at all. I'm just recovering from a little bit of a setback, but I am doing okay.
You sound very good, and we really wish you well. We know that you're getting the professional attention, and you're in a good and important battle in your health. Charles, the battle that you have been like a bulldog on and you won't let go is that the Canadian government says that if you want to be a citizen, you have to swear allegiance to Her Majesty and to her family and her corgis and the various others. Now, everybody says, well, Charles, that's simple. You just throw your conscience in the lake and do it.
Yes.
Tell us why you're not doing it.
For some people, it's very easy because it's a matter of convenience. But with me, an oath or a pledge of allegiance is very important. You know, it's something that is public. And once you take that oath, you're supposed to abide with it, as opposed to just take it as a formality. I haven't taken it for the reason that, I was born in the British colony of Trinidad and Tobago.
So you were born a subject.
Yes.
When did you become an object?
Well, I came to Canada in 1955, and at that time I was still a British subject. And somewhere along the way, they snatched that away from me. I think it's around 1977. I came here in 1955, mm-hmm. and at that time, as a British subject, I became landed, and I was allowed to vote, and I could even stand for office if I wanted to. I can't do any of those things now. I joined the Canadian Army. I was in that for 3 years.
So you defended the crown?
Well, like
gratis?
one of those loyal Negroes who comrades of the crown. I did defend the crown.
By the way, I caught you on CBC mentioning that you're also Irish. So you
yes.
You are bringing together two big powerful peoples.
Yes, I'm a mixed race person, as most West Indians are, and we have had a class action in which we had persons who were of many different backgrounds. We had one who was Irish, Mike McAteer. We had an Indian, mm-hmm. Ashok Charles. We had a Jewish person, mm-hmm. who Howard Gomberg. Mm-hmm. And it was quite a mixture of people and myself, you know. Mm-hmm. And we presented that we were all Canadians of different backgrounds and so on. None of us were of what you might call the royal lineage. Mm-hmm. So we thought that since we were in a country which embraces multiculturalism and embraces the idea of inclusiveness.
And how about freedom of conscience?
Oh, well, that's a very important thing, and that's one of the fundamental freedoms. But I don't believe the Canadian government cares about that. They said anyone, irrespective of what you think, anyone who wants to be a citizen of this country, if you're not born here, you must take this oath to be loyal and bear true allegiance to Elizabeth II, her heirs, and successors, whoever they might be, I suppose. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't get
what
myself...
What could go wrong with that?
Yeah. I couldn't get myself to do that. And mm-hmm. people say, oh, it's just a symbol. But symbols have a way of becoming a real power.
Yes.
And
it
was
so in my case.
People
have been burned at the stake about this.
Yeah. This is a science of what they call semiotics, which is part of mass propaganda, which can turn symbols into realities. And in my case, I know it's not a symbol because If it were, I don't know they would be forcing you to take it.
There's two ends to the rope.
If there's no power to it. But there's a lot of power to it because I won't take it, I can't get a passport. Mm-hmm. And so when I travel to Africa and so on, if I travel on a Trinidad and Tobago mm-hmm. passport, and I have to get visas to get into Europe and to get into parts of Africa and so on, it's very inconvenient.
Yes, so that is a lot of power.
Yeah, I believe once I was traveling from Tanzania, and I think you were with me.
I think I was.
And
if you're looking for a witness, I'm holding my right hand up.
Yes
that's
and
true.
I couldn't come through because I didn't have
And we left you behind, I remember.
Yes. I had to make a circuitous trip through New York to come here.
Charles, let me ask you, you've had, people that appreciate, some judges have agreed with you.
Yes, we have had two judges, one of the Federal Court of Appeal and one of the Supreme Court of Ontario, who said that this requirement, a compulsory requirement that persons in my class must swear an oath to be faithful and true and bear true allegiance to Her Majesty, may be in violation of a number of fundamental rights under Section 2 of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Mm-hmm. Because compelled speech is really denial of freedom of speech. Mm-hmm. And some people just go through this and take the oath because they're compelled to do it, and it is so inconvenient if they don't do it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I have held out because, you know, there's a little story behind this. I came to this country in 1955. That was the year, in December of that year, Rosa Parks sat down and didn't give up a seat to a white man. Because the law at that time demanded that you give up your seat in her kind of situation. Her action was so powerful, and I saw this on television, which came to Canada for the first time in 1955, mm-hmm. and it was such a powerful thing to me that I felt that I had to embrace and follow her lead and not demean myself by taking an oath to this English family and to this Constitution of Canada, because the Constitution of Canada, to my mind, is a racial constitution. We're living in what you might call an apartheid state. Our Constitution in Canada is apartheid in that mm-hmm. it holds that only a certain race and a certain lineage of people could hold the highest rank in Canada, which is the head of state.
Mm-hmm.
So a constitutional monarchy, Phil, mm-hmm. is by definition racial mm-hmm. and deals in racial superiority. Mm-hmm. So I had devoted myself, my whole life, to fighting against racism, fighting against imperialism in all its forms and so on, mm-hmm. and there was no way I could just turn my back on that and just take this oath, even though it cost me a lot. For example, I was invited to take up the position of a provincial judge, mm-hmm. which is big bucks, you know, in payment, you know what I mean? And in pensions.
Right away, you're talking about the kind of principles that they understand.
Yes, and so I couldn't take that job, mm-hmm. and I had to pass it by, even though it meant $300,000 a year, mm. plus two-thirds of that for my pension. So, but I didn't take it, you know. So I figured that, look, I cannot demean myself and demean the heritage of those who I so admire, you know, the Rosa Parks, the Martin Luther Kings, and so on. So that's a kind of suffering. Of course,
yeah.
I'm not doing so badly otherwise, but but still.
Yeah. But it does show, by the way, the power. That story of Rosa Parks, I mean, she empowered and incited courage in people. I mean, it's just that you would tell that story, that's just remarkable. And it led to change of conduct, which, of course, ultimately will lead to changes. And the fact that judges now agree, there was a time when they would just smirk and and as they used to say, laugh you out of court. That is not happening now. No, I notice more and more Canadians are listening more closely to what you're telling them, and it is starting to sink in.
Yeah, 3 weeks ago we were in court.
God bless your persistence, as a man.
Well. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you're right. We're moving ahead, and we're going to be back in court by September, and I hope by then things will turn around. Mm-hmm. And people are beginning to understand what it means when we say equal dignity.
Yes.
Equal dignity in not having one ethnic group bow down to another ethnic group, you know.
Yes.
And people now are understanding why the monarchy really is a sort of sugar-coated symbol of imperialism and a symbol of national and racial superiority.
Yes.
People didn't quite understand it before.
Yeah,
and I've been saying that all along, that all kinds of discrimination that we see has its fountain head or its origin in this monarchy business, you know.
Yes.
Discrimination on the basis of class, on the basis of language,
yes,
accent, family status, mm-hmm, ethnicity, even yes, religion, all of these discriminations are based on this sugar-coated symbol of monarchy, which we are holding on to. And this Harper government seems to elevate so much these days, you know.
Yes, and they're also running out of sugar, so it's not such a pleasant. It's getting more demeaning. Charles, before we go, though, I have to make sure I take you up on you mentioned being in Tanzania. You people should understand that practiced international law, represented accused persons in Grenada,
yes,
and in Rwanda, and they have now established an international criminal court. They had these things called ad hoc courts.
Yes, and which are dying out.
And they said they're going to end impunity. Well, what do you think they've achieved so far?
Well, the International Criminal Court, which is just getting on its feet, I wish it could work, but it cannot. Mm-hmm. The reason it cannot work is that in this world we have a couple or three very, very powerful countries. And with a powerful country like the United States, or like Russia, or even China, courts cannot work. Mm-hmm. And the reason that courts cannot work with very powerful countries is that a court needs certain basic ingredients, so to speak. It needs a prosecutor. It needs investigators, and it needs a police force or an army or something like that to mm-hmm, follow through its orders and so on. And you cannot have that where you have these powerful countries, which are more powerful than any army that the court itself could amass.
Yes.
So the United States, for example, has had a position where it would enter into bilateral agreements with all the small countries that they not send any U.S. national to The Hague or to be prosecuted by the World Court, the Criminal Court.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason, they have three reasons which, in a way, don't make sense and which we are very, very practical. One reason is that, look, we, the United States, a nation, we will punish our own war criminals, our own mm-hmm, persons who violate international criminal standards. And we won't be afraid to do that. We did that with Oliver North. We did that in My Lai. We did it. We even attempted to indict a president, President Clinton, you know. So we're not like all these other nations who would give a pass to its heads and so on. So we are beyond this court. And then the other thing is, look, we are the only nation that has the ability to investigate certain kinds of wrongdoing. Mm-hmm. Suppose somebody blows up a space station, or mm-hmm, suppose there's a terrorist activity mm-hmm, on the bottom of the Pacific Ocean. Who can investigate that? No one except us, the United States. We are the only ones who have the know-how and and the power and the will to do that. So investigation is the heart of all kinds of criminal justice or injustice of any kind. And if you can't investigate, you cannot carry out a court. The other thing is, who will go out and enforce the court's decision? If the court says, okay, we want you to go and arrest so and so, we want you to go and put this person in jail or bring him, who can do that? Who has the power to go into these nations? Who can go into Libya? Or who can go into Syria? Only us, you know. And so then it's just a joke to have us bowing down to the jurisdiction of a court which cannot have jurisdiction over us because it's much, much too weak.
Mm-hmm.
So this is why, unless we had a situation with lots of small nations and a very powerful court, international criminal law cannot work.
Mm-hmm.
The only hope I can see for it is when some nations or some small nations do this token business of saying, okay, we're going to ourselves form a court. And this is just symbolic, and this is just to shame people, you know. But it has no real meaning and no real power. And people just laugh at it as... like they did recently with a court that held a number of Americans responsible for various war crimes.
Yes, the one in South Africa, I think they had a meeting.
Yes, and so what? You can't. What are you going to do now? You find me guilty. What are you going to do with that now?
Mm-hmm.
You can't do anything, you know. So it's very bleak, so far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
So far as international criminal justice is concerned, many. NGOs and individuals now are taking bold steps of like they're doing in the Belgian Congo and or in some places, and shaming or putting pressure on individuals like this fellow Kony, and making the world really, really upset. But then, what are you going to do unless you have the recognition of the United States?
Mm-hmm.
The Soviet Union, China, these big countries, they've got to make a move, a serious move, where they'll hand over their nationals to a court like that.
Yes.
If they hand over Kissinger, you know, or if they hand over some of these people.
Blair. People ask for Blair.
If they hand over Blair, and that will clear the way now for... For a true understanding of what criminal justice would be.
Yeah. When as soon as you say the name Blair, you realize that you're back to the same joke that the monarchy constitutes, and you realize no, this is a non-starter.
Yeah.
Charles Roach, well, you're a big hero of ours and CIUT, and it's great to talk to you. Thank you very, very much.
Okay, thanks to the Taylor Report.
Okay, talk to you soon. Bye bye. That's Charles Roach, and. He'd been a lot of great battles, and he never turns a hair. Charles is serene. I've watched him in many struggles, and he's got the gift of anybody who represents a great cause. He's unflappable. He can say, I'm not going to swear that oath to the Queen, and everybody faints or takes a breath or goes outside. But by the way, I was doing my homework to talk to Charles, and James II, refused to take the oath in order to become... He had to take an oath called the test, saying that he wasn't a Catholic or he didn't like certain Catholic practices or else he couldn't be the admiral of the Navy. And he said, I won't do it. He at that time was the Duke of York. So they said, oh, okay. So then 12 years later, they made him the king. So maybe someday we'll have Charles Zero become the king.
Well, Phil, I always like to point out that... a Catholic cannot be the head of state in Canada because that's a British law, and we're subject to it.
Yes. Well, and now that we have a man online who's not a Catholic. It's Zafar Bengash.
Hello,
Zafar.
Hello, Phil. How are you?
Very good. Thanks for being patient with us.
No problem.
This is Zafar Bengash. He's traveled all through the region that we're going to ask about. He certainly knows all the figures and what these issues are about. And I want to start with one that, Zafar, that we had been talking about a couple of weeks ago. Apropos of the Syrian crisis, a group of pilgrims from Lebanon were kidnapped by someone who put their lives in danger, and apparently they've surrendered. There were women, and then there were men, and they've given up the women, but they're holding the men. And it seems to involve countries like Turkey, where some of these gentlemen operate. There's a suggestion Turkey might have been involved in their kidnapping. But this is not being talked about here at all.
Yes, exactly.
Can you tell us what this is about? And why doesn't the Canadian government, for example, the American British government, say, release those people?
Exactly. This is the kind of strange situation that we find ourselves in when it comes to reporting on Syria, that anything that would expose the true nature of what is referred to as the Free Syrian Army, it is nothing but a bunch of thugs and gangsters that have been given massive amounts of weapons and money by the Saudis, the Qataris, by Turkey, as well as the U.S. and Israel. And as you mentioned, they had kidnapped these Lebanese pilgrims. In fact, these Lebanese pilgrims were being tracked most probably by Turkey's intelligence agency, and the information was provided to members of the so-called Free Syrian Army. Mm-hmm. And the aim was to try to implicate Hezbollah and to present these pilgrims as members of Hezbollah, and that to suggest that Hezbollah fighters were assisting the Syrian army. But these happened to be ordinary pilgrims, and and of course...
Were they also hoping to create violence within Lebanon?
Exactly, because unfortunately the conflict in Syria has now spilled into Lebanon as well, particularly in the north. And in Lebanon, of course, there are two groups that are heavily financed by the Saudis. One is the Salafi groups, which is essentially Al-Qaeda. And here is, you know, I think our listeners should pay attention to this, that the U.S. and Canada and NATO, they tell us that they are fighting against Al-Qaeda. But they are actually financing Al-Qaeda in Syria.
Yes.
And they're doing it through Saudi Arabia, which is their
ally.
And
I'm so glad you raised that, because, you know, Zafar, over the years we've spoken to you as the authority on this region, and you've been right on the money. I can recall an interview with you where we were discussing the new phenomenon called the Taliban.
Yes.
And it was called at that time in the Western media a student movement.
Right.
And it was fighting in Afghanistan.
Right.
And your remark was that it's the first student movement in history to have an Air Force.
Well, I'm glad you remember that.
Now, you know, people have to appreciate, because here we are. I mean, I hate to say it. I feel like the old 60s expression, mind games. But we're talking about the U.S., which was intimately involved with financing and arming these people.
Yes, exactly.
And then they want to scare us, oh, the bad Taliban are coming to get you, or the bad Al-Qaeda.
Yes.
But they're the ones who paid and armed them.
Absolutely, absolutely. Like, you know, the Syria actually exposes this whole charade so well that, you know, for years we've been told that the U.S. was fighting against Al-Qaeda. Even today, they go around bombing and killing innocent people in Yemen and Pakistan, and they say, oh, we killed Al-Qaeda, you know, operative.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, they are financing Al-Qaeda in Syria. So how come? Is it there are two separate branches of Al-Qaeda, that one is the good Al-Qaeda, the other is the bad Al-Qaeda? What is it? We are totally confused about this. You know, would the Americans mm-hmm. please enlighten us as to what is it they are doing?
Mm-hmm.
But to come back to these hostages, it's a very serious issue, because the women that were released, they, of course, saw their kidnappers, and they were able to identify one of the spokespersons for the so-called Free Syrian Army, who is ensconced in Turkey. And they pointed out, they said, yes, this is the guy who keeps on issuing out mm-hmm. press statements from Turkey. He was one of our kidnappers.
Yes.
So here is Turkey giving shelter to kidnappers, to international outlaws. And here is the West, led by the U.S. and Israel and Saudi Arabia and Qatar, mm-hmm. etc., financing these outlaws, giving them weapons, giving them money, projecting their propaganda. and they're kidnapping innocent civilians.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, as you said, the other intention was, the purpose was to instigate sectarian violence in Lebanon. And unfortunately, given the divisions in Lebanon, it is very prone to sectarian violence.
Mm-hmm.
But we again see another contradiction in Lebanon itself, that there are two different groups in Lebanon that the U.S. is supporting. And the person, the American who's intimately involved in this is Jeffrey Feltman,
mm-hmm.
who used to be a former ambassador in Lebanon. Currently, he's the undersecretary for Near Eastern Affairs, etc., and Barack Obama's Middle East point man.
I hear he's going to get a U.N. job.
Yes, he's about to be given a U.N. job. I mean, this is incredible that, you know, now he's going to go into the U.N. to act as the in the political bureau of the U.N. And so he's a person who has his hands fully, engrossed in the internal situation in Lebanon and trying to instigate sectarian violence over there. So the two groups in Lebanon that are financed by the U.S. and the Saudis are, number one, Al-Qaeda in Lebanon, mm-hmm. and second is the Saad Hariri group. And Saad Hariri is a playboy who spends most of his time in Paris nightclubs. And so you see that...
He's secular on Fridays.
Yes, exactly. So you see the Al-Qaeda group that are supposed to be very rigid, doctrinaire, Salafis who follow, mm-hmm. you know, the rigid strictures of Islam, etc. And they are now aligned with Saad Hariri and his group, who are completely secular, who drink and who womanize and who party in nightclubs, etc. And I don't know exactly, this is sort of, you know, to my mind, this is so confusing.
Yes.
I don't know what to make of this whole thing.
It's rather like being at a theater, I think, where the actors are asking us to believe them.
Yes, exactly.
About this matter, the Free Syrian Army, and you've characterized them as basically gangs, and they're extremely violent. But you notice, now they've just chosen a new leader, and apparently there was quite a joke about this, because the West wanted them to name a Christian so that they could say they're, you know, have a broad united front.
Yeah, secular and liberal, exactly.
They ended up naming a Kurdish gentleman who no one had ever heard of before.
Yes.
But my understanding, the Kurds of Syria have no use for him and have no use for actually for the Free Syrian Army.
Exactly. You see, there is a desperate attempt by opponents of the government in Syria to try to instigate the Kurds in Syria against the regime in Syria. Now, the Kurds in Syria have not in any way been targeted or molested in the manner in which Turkey has targeted them in their country. And in fact, the Kurds in Syria are one of the cards that the Syrian government has threatened Turkey with to use to
mm-hmm.
tell them that if you continue to meddle in our affairs and you continue to arm these thugs and gangsters that are perpetrating massacres in Syria, that we could unleash the Kurds against you. Because there is, you know, a few years ago, the Turks kidnapped Abdullah Öcalan, who is the head of the PKK. And, of course, Abdullah Öcalan used to take refuge in Syria,
mm-hmm.
and Syria refused to hand him over to Turkey. So Öcalan was simply exiled from Syria, and he was then kidnapped by the Turks from the Greek embassy in Africa.
Uh-huh, in Nairobi. Yeah,
Nairobi, exactly. So you see that, there is something that the Syrian government has in its power to use against Turkey if Turkey continues to play this dirty game.
Mm-hmm.
And as you mentioned, this Kurdish unknown figure from the Kurdish group that was appointed as head of the Syrian National Council, which is again a bunch of jokers that have absolutely no standing inside Syria. There are definitely groups inside Syria that have much greater standing with the people and much greater credibility.
Mm-hmm.
But the Syrian National Council is basically a foreign creation to present a foreign face to the uprising so that the U.S. and the West and NATO and their Middle Eastern monarchical allies can present these people as credible representatives of the Syrian people.
Zafar Bengais, that's great. That's a terrific summary. We appreciate you giving us the time.
Sure, it's my great pleasure.
And we look forward to talking to you again.
Absolutely. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye. Zafar Bengais and Crescent International, and you can find, just go Zafar Bengais. You're better at it than I am anyhow. Listen, this is the Taylor Report. Write us, taylor@ciut.fm, and check us out, taylor-report.com. And thanks to Carol, thanks to Phil. We'll see you next week.